Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
I'm Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to episode 11 of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic here at WGNplus.com. Thank you for clicking on Captain Podtastic from the end of the web to your screen every Monday. It's posted at WGNplus.com. And thank you for joining us today. I wanted to get right into something in the news because I can bring a little personal aspect to something in the news, and so I wanted to go right to the source. If you've noticed in the sports page lately, about a week or so ago, Chris Sale, the Chicago White Sox ace pitcher, all star, probably one of the best pitchers in baseball, did something very interesting. They had a throwback uniform promotion at Sox Park, and he did not particularly like the 1976. Throwback uniforms. He did, and they were supposed to wear them for the day that he was pitching. He didn't like them so much that I don't know what he used. I don't know if he used scissors, if he used box cutters, I don't know what he used, a chainsaw. He used something, but apparently he cut up several of the uniforms on game day, apparently, so that they could not wear them. And so they had to wear a different one. And if you know what these uniforms look like, they're from 1976. It was during the Bill Veeck era, when Bill Veeck owned the Chicago White Sox, and it was an odd uniform. I don't know if it was ever really a type of style. From what I may have remembered about this, Bill Veeck's wife may have designed it, but it was trying to recapture some of the old-time vintage uniforms of the early days of baseball in the 19-aughts and 10s and 20s. It had a collar in the front, but it was a faux collar in that the collar didn't go all the way around the neck. You didn't tuck the shirt in. It hung out, and it was kind of rounded. The lettering was old vintage letters, the font with kind of curly cues on them. The colors were just flat. In fact, they were black and white. One was just all black. Everybody remembers, even though players today in baseball don't even really wear stirrup socks, they just wear their pants all the way down to their shoes. But most baseball uniforms, at least in the 70s when these came out, you had something called stirrup socks, where you wore a pair of white socks, and then you wore another sock over that had sort of a thin stripe that went up your leg, and then some stripes that went around your calf. These didn't even have that. They just had some white socks with stripes on them. They totally stood out. They were universally panned by everyone, sportscasters, fans, the White Sox players themselves. No one could look good in these uniforms. They were very blousy. They were a mess. But Chris Sale tore them up, because he said they weren't comfortable. And that's where I have to call Chris Sale out. Because from 1980, 1981, and 1982, I was a member of the St. Patrick's High School baseball team, St. Pat's, right here on the northwest side of Chicago, good old Belmont and Austin. And I wore that uniform. My baseball coach, Paul Demos, was a huge, and still is, a huge Sox fan, and to show his loyalty to the team, he ordered those uniforms up for us. And for my 3 years on the varsity, I had to wear those things. They were ugly as hell, but I take issue with Chris Sale by saying that they were not comfortable, because I do believe they were comfortable. And so I'm going to go right to the source here, and I'm very excited to talk to my old baseball coach, Paul Demos. How you doing there, coach?
Pretty good. How you doing, Jimmy?
Not too bad. I did mention to our listeners here that this whole Chris Sale controversy about him tearing up the 1976 throwback uniforms because they were uncomfortable, I will admit that they were ugly, but I know for a fact that they were comfortable because for three seasons, we wore those uniforms at good old St. Pat's, the Shamrocks. And so I figured I would call you up to set the record straight because you were the guy who dressed us in those uniforms.
Well, yeah, it could have been worse, too. There's one aspect of the uniforms you forgot to mention.
What's that?
There's an extension of these uniforms, which was supposed to be for Sundays, and they were only worn once, which was the short pants.
Yeah, they actually were. Now, if you're playing baseball, you have to slide.
Yeah, well, that's why they had the knee-high socks with those. They did it one game, and then the players must have said, we'll never do this again. But yeah, I'm glad you mentioned this was all a Bill Veeck innovation. I mean,
wasn't it his wife who...
That I don't recall.
I heard that Mary Frances may have had a hand in designing those.
Bill Veeck was known as Barnum Bill. First exploding scoreboard in baseball. First one to have fireworks after a game. And I also think, I could be wrong, but he may have been the one who came up with the concept of Ladies' Day at the ballpark, which they don't have anymore.
And he also put the vines up at Wrigley Field.
He put the vines up at Wrigley Field when he was, he wasn't general manager.
No, wasn't his dad a part of the team or something?
Yeah, there was some hookup there. And, yeah, he's the one who was responsible for the vines there. He's the one who is also responsible for what the Cubs still do today is the take me out to the ball game with now they have their celebrity singers. It was Bill Veeck who did that, who hired Harry Carey and brought him to Chicago.
Right, from St. Louis.
Yeah, and from Oakland.
Oh, Oakland, that's right.
Yeah, he had gone 1 year for Oakland.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And then he hired him from Oakland. Harry Carey was not happy in Oakland at all. And he noticed that Harry would always sing along, take me out to the ballgame in the seventh inning. He would lip it, you know. And one day he told him, leave the microphone on when he does it. And caught Harry Carey by surprise, and the whole stadium heard him singing.
Right.
And Veeck said, I've been looking for someone like you all my life, someone who has such a bad voice that the fans would not be intimidated to sing along. And that's how that started.
Well, Bill Veeck, Bill Veeck was certainly a showman. He brought a lot of fun. Sadly, when he was with the Sox, he did not have a lot of money, and that was in the era, just the beginning in the era of free agency. And so
exactly, and he didn't value as much keeping prospects like they do today. He traded some real good young players away to get some older veterans, but again, like you said, he did the best he could with a limited budget.
Well, you're doing a good job of deflecting, but
so that's how, I mean, all these innovations, that's how he came up with, he wanted something different, uniforms.
So
I got them for you guys at St. Pat's, it wasn't that I thought they were so attractive. It was, I guess, we were a newer program, and I wanted something different to create a little splash, and they did.
So you were the Bill Veeck of the IHSA baseball.
Could be. Yeah, actually, you're very fortunate. I don't know if it was your team or a year ahead. I had a call from the Sox that they, because I had a friend who was their farm director, C.V. Davis, and that's how I became affiliated with the White Sox, with their tryout camps and scoutings like that. And there was a girl who Bill Veeck wanted to give a tryout to. And it was all a PR thing. But he didn't want to just bring her in an empty thing. He wanted to see if he could put her on a team and play a game and try her out.
Wait a minute. Were you going to have her play on our team?
Well, I'll tell you what it was. I mean, I got the
God. You are Demos Barnum.
Well, no, I got, you know, they were going to, this was Bill Veeck's idea, and I went to the athletic director, and I went to the principal, and told him about this at the time, and said, what do you think? I even went to our legendary basketball, Max Kurland.
Oh, my God.
He just thought it was wonderful, any publicity we could get.
Right.
And we were going to do it, except it would be, we'd have, it wouldn't be a conference game, of course.
Right.
exhibition game with someone. We'd had some press out there and stuff like that. And but the White Sox decided not to do it for whatever reason.
And we should also mention, you talk about some of Bill Veeck's, because this certainly is right up Bill Veeck's alley, because, of course, he's, in addition to some of the things that we mentioned that he's known for in terms of different aspects of the game that we now take for granted, but one of his most, I guess, infamous, exploits or stunts, whatever you would call it, didn't he put up a little person,
Eddie Goodell,
who was only about 2 or 3 feet high.
Yeah,
and or wasn't that in a World Series or a playoff game?
No, it was a regular game. He actually had him signed to a contract.
But he was so small that they'd have to walk him because they couldn't throw him a strike.
His strike zone, they said, was literally 3 inches high. He was dying for the situation to come up with the bases loaded.
Where they need a walk to walk a run in. Yeah.
Yes, to pinch hit for him. But also, his biggest fear was, what if he got up there and decided, caught up in the moment, and wanted to take a swing?
Right, exactly.
And so supposedly, allegedly, he told Eddie Goodell, I'm going to be up in the press box with a rifle. If I see you take a swing, I'm going to shoot you.
Well, I should say that as much as Paul Demos here, who not only was the coach of the varsity team in St. Patrick for how many seasons?
10.
I mean, you actually started the baseball program at St. Pat's.
Well, I was one of the leading pushers of it, yeah.
Yeah. And so, like in the Bill Veeck tradition, I suppose, you were an innovator. But we also should say that you also had some very successful teams. So it wasn't just that you were a showman. You actually had put some good teams on the field. And I'm very proud of the fact that in 1981, I was a member of the 1981 St. Pat's team, and we won the regional championship.
Yes, against some very tough teams.
Yeah, and so
very tough conference.
Yeah, we always. I mean, the one thing I thought always about St. Pat's is that we always had very solid, well coached, competitive, and I would even say scrappy teams. And in many situations, that 81 team that I was on, we had a very good team, but I also think that we a little overachieved, that no one expected us to be, in the regional, and certainly not the regional champs at that time.
Sure.
But I think that we were a very scrappy team, we were very confident, and you and Bob Miller were the coaches, and we had a very fun and successful season, and I always enjoyed playing with those guys, and a lot of those guys are still my friends today, except for the fact that we had to wear these horribly ugly uniforms. So now you've done a good job of giving us a history of Bill Veeck, a history of baseball. Still got to get back to one of your mortal sins.
The uniform.
Your mortal sins was dressing us up.
Was it comfortable?
Oh, yes. Okay, so that's my point. They were as ugly as hell. I'm sorry, you can't justify that. Now, you told me when I called you up about this that you had worn...
Yeah.
Since you did do some things with the White Sox and did some tryouts and some scouting, that there were occasions where you wore the uniform and found it to be very comfortable.
We had to do. I'd help them run the tryout camps, which they held at Sox Park, they always had us wearing the uniforms, whatever they were. And there was that one year that we did wear those uniforms, and just talking to the full-time scouts and personnel of the White Sox, getting feedback of, how the players liked them. And he said, for the most part, they didn't. But they did, most of them did feel they were extremely comfortable. What Chris Sale, I read, did not like is the jersey did not tuck in. And he's never had a uniform or the jersey didn't tucked in. The other thing, I don't know how it would have been for a pitcher if that collar was flapping at all. So that's, I don't know what other reason he'd have had to do that. And I don't think it would have been just because he thought the uniforms were ugly.
No, I think there was a lot of other things going on there. They were talking about him. You know, he's had some problems with the front office. He was very outspoken during the LaRoche controversy with his child being in the clubhouse.
Yeah.
This, I think he was talking about management favoring marketing. over the team or competitiveness because, you know, as we know, I don't, maybe some people don't know, that, that pitchers are allowed to choose which uniform to wear what day they pitch.
That's right.
And so what he was mad about, that he wasn't supposed to pitch on that date, but there was a change in the rotation, and suddenly he was pitching on that day. It may have even had to do with something with the All-Star lineup, since he did play in the All-Star game. But suddenly he was pitching on the day where they, where these uniforms were going to be worn. And so he did not get a chance to choose because management said, no, no, we're doing a promotion. We're giving these jerseys away.
Yeah.
And so we want the team to be wearing the jerseys during the game that we're giving away. So Sale hit. So whatever his thing is, I, like I said, my problem was with this is I said, no, no, I wore those uniforms for 3 years. And while they were ugly, and I don't even know if you knew this, but you know, because I was the catcher, and so I was always near the dugouts of the other teams. And the guys would come up and, you know, we would say a few words to all the players and even the umpires. So I was always used to you know, chat with these guys. I've always been a talker. That's why I'm right. That's why I'm doing this right now. And I don't know if you know, but I can't remember. I think it was either a, an umpire or one team. During the game, he called us the St. PJs.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because they looked like pajamas.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I wouldn't have given him his paycheck at the end of the game. I know that. You know, you should add, you talked about scrappy teams. You were on the varsity team from sophomore year.
Yes, yes.
As a starting catcher for the varsity team.
Yeah, no, and I and I, and I appreciate your confidence in me. That was a great...
Heck of a good ball player.
No, that was a great honor, and I was...
You said you talk a lot. That's where you do this. You don't have to remind me. you were chatty.
Yeah, but I always used to. But I always used to talk to the batters and talk to the pitchers as well as they pitched and encouraged them.
It was a positive chatty.
Yeah.
It was a very positive chatty.
But so here's the thing. So, I mean, so that's interesting. I never knew the fact. Now, but here's the thing that I always found interesting. Now, 1980 was the first year that you brought those uniforms, and yet the White Sox at that time had stopped wearing them, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So why would you have resurrected those?
Well, because we were getting new uniforms. Our old one were getting a little thin, and so the athletic director said it's in the budget to get new uniforms. So I was looking through the catalog, and there they were.
So they actually were in. So those were. I thought you had those specially made. No.
No, they were in. They were in a catalog. I don't think anyone else bought them. but I saw that, and I said, yeah, that's bingo.
So now, I mean, I should say that not only maybe were you trying to emulate Bill Veeck and maybe bring a little you know, attention to our team through the uniforms, but you are a diehard Sox fan. And so certainly this was, I would assume that this was also kind of a way to pay homage to your favorite team, right?
Well, yeah, probably.
Yeah. I think it's okay to admit it. Doesn't matter. The uniforms are gone now. It was 30 years ago.
That's a fair statement.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
The other day when those uniforms were getting a little worn and we were getting new uniforms, and you never wore the new ones, I guess?
No, you
wore this uniform all 3 years.
That was the only 3 years. Of course, so for 3 years, we had those uniforms, and then I graduate in 1982, and the next year, they get new uniforms, and they were beautiful uniforms.
Yeah, they were our sharpest ones.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, so thanks a lot. So you wait until I graduate.
I remember over the winter seeing one of the opposing coaches in the league telling him about it. I said, hey, we're getting new uniforms this year, and he says, it's about time. You were embarrassed, weren't you?
Well, I have to say that, you know, once again, and you used to come, I mean, when, you know, before a game would start, you know, Coach Demos would come out and hit infield practice to the team. So you used to come out on the field with wearing the uniform as well.
Oh, we had to as a league.
Yeah, but I just remember, I don't know, once again, I'm not sure how you were aware. I'm always kind of aware of my surroundings. And I just remember, almost to a game, I mean, aside from our people in our conference who saw us play, and we played them a couple of times, so they got used to seeing those uniforms. But when we played non-conference games or teams that we had never played before, when we even got off the bus, people would, I mean, there was this kind of oddity factor, like, is that the team? Because they kind of looked like softball uniforms at that time. you know, where with the with they were very blousy, the pants were very loose. It was just a very, as I said, in terms of comfort, it was fantastic. You know, aesthetically, it was, and no one looked good in that uniform.
Well, it worked, though, because we were good. We had a good team.
Yeah, so that was actually the thing about it, was that
we
had
a winning, we were a winning team.
Yeah, we were winning ugly, just like the White Sox.
Yeah, well, I won't say we were winning ugly. We were pretty
no, no, I mean we were in ugly uniforms.
Oh, yeah, okay, I got you. I picked that up.
But, no, and that's the thing. We actually, I think you're right. We actually could have made those uniforms cool, because you could make fun of us of the way we looked, but we were beating you.
Then you beat them on the field. Now, if we were a terrible team and couldn't catch the ball or anything, then, of course, then it would have been a big joke.
I think
we would have been a joke.
I think, and I think I may have even said this at the time, but I may have, I mean, after a while, I mean, having worn them for 3 years, I mean, by that time, the oddity of it, you know, was past me. I just remember being a sophomore, and you know, and all the guys were kind of like, "Whoa, what's this?" And I think I may have even called them the boy named Sue uniforms, because it was almost like, if you remember that song, "A Boy Named Sue."
Sure.
The father says to the guy, "I named you Sue because you need to be tough.
You need to be tough.
You know, if I gave you a regular name, you wouldn't need to be tough. But if I'm naming you Sue, you're going to get picked on. You're going to get name called. And so you're going to have to learn how to defend yourself." And so to your point, you know, we were this kind of scrappy Northwest side of Chicago team that was a relatively new program. And so in some ways, but being dressed that way, you did sort of give us a little mental toughness, as we had to prove that we could play better than those uniforms.
And you did.
Yeah. So maybe you're psych. You know, now I'm thinking, maybe, you know what, after all these years, I think you were a genius.
Well, there you go.
I mean, for all these years, I've never thought that until right now. You may have been a psychological genius.
You've got to be good to pull off stuff like that.
You may have willed us to win that regional championship.
That was it.
In fact, the funny thing is, in my 3 years, you know, I should say that, you know, in fact, it was just until recently that 1981 team was the farthest that any team had gone in the IHSA playoffs, until a few years ago when the team actually went to the finals.
I think it was 1974 that we did first get baseball at St.
74,
day.
Okay. But I have...
It wasn't even announced that we'd get baseball until Christmas break.
And really? Wow. And then 3 months later, you got to field the team.
And then what the athletic director wanted to do at the time said, let's just start out with a freshman team.
Oh.
And then next year at a sophomore varsity. And I didn't want that. I said, no, I want to get a full thing.
Yeah.
And we had tryouts in the gym.
Yeah, right. That's what you had to do. Yeah.
For first time, where we had like about 250 tryout in the gym for a team in East Suburban Catholic, was a very tough conference at the time.
Well, Marist had won the state championship, and they were a member of that conference.
Well, yeah, they were later on. Yes, they were. And then, you had some really good teams, and we had the tryouts in the gym, I recall, and it was a terrible spring as far as weather goes. We had snowstorm and everything. We had our first 10 practice games rained out or snowed out. We had never played a game, and our first game was a conference game, a doubleheader against the team favored to win the conference, Notre Dame, on the road. And we got killed in a doubleheader, and we had a losing year, although at the end of the year we actually won our district in the first year.
Well, I have to say, the 3 years that I was on the team, we won in 81, my junior year, we won the regional. And while we lost in the sectionals to go downstate, we did lose to the team that ultimately won the state championship that year. So we certainly didn't lose to a slouch team.
No, that's right. We lost to Oak Park, who won the championship.
Yeah, the year before, if you remember, was heartbreaking for me personally, because we were battling for, I believe, the conference. Or it was, I'm not sure if it was a conference or it was.
It was.
It was for the conference championship.
Yeah.
And I was a sophomore, and, you know, so, I mean, I'm a little intimidated of being on the team anyway, because I was a starter. And so a lot of people are wondering, well, who the hell is this guy? Especially the seniors. and even some of the juniors, like, well, why is he playing in front of me? So that wasn't an easy time for me, and you were very...
Important position as catcher.
But I'm saying, but you were very helpful in easing that, because I'm sure that some of the players were looking at me kind of cross-eyed, like, well, who the hell is this big, you know, big deal guy? So I didn't try to be over the top and things, but I was able to fit in with the team. And incredibly, as it was almost like the natural, it was like a movie. So it's the bottom, we're at, it was a home game, we're playing Marist for the conference championship, we are tied, there are two outs, we were losing by two runs, there were two outs, and with two outs, we tied the game with two or three runs. And it was in the bottom of the ninth. And sure enough, I get up to bat with the bags jammed, two outs.
This is at Reese Park, right?
At Reese Park, and we're down by one run now.
And you hit a line drive.
And I hit a shot, which...
Real shot. Which
it was right over the shortstop's head between left field and center field.
You hit it too hard.
Well, that was a problem. And I hit it, and when I saw it take off, I knew it was a hit. I was so excited because, you know, once again, I was a sophomore on this team, and I knew that we were going to win the game. Two runs were going to score on this hit because it was in the gap.
Yeah.
And as I hit first base, and I'm rounding the bag, I look at the umpire at first base, and he gives the out sign.
Yeah.
And I was like, "What?" Because I didn't watch the ball after I hit it because I knew it was a hit.
It stayed up, and the left fielder caught it.
And apparently this guy made a shoestring catch and made a great catch, and we lost on that. And it was like went from hero to nothing in 40 seconds. But that was a heartbreaking loss. We did win the regional. And then if you remember my senior year, we were fighting for the regional championship, and we lost on a play at the plate.
Yeah.
On a sacrifice bunt.
Well, yeah, I remember that one very well.
I remember your reaction to that one, too, because you didn't think that the call went our way.
Oh, what it was is it was a suicide squeeze, and the runner was, I can remember the runner, who was Kevin Hodges.
Yeah.
And he was called safe, and that was the game. We should have won.
Right.
Except for the fact the coach who was – one of the big coaches in the state from Oak Park, Jack Kaiser, the late Jack Kaiser, he yelled to the umpire, he didn't slide. Well, they had put in a rule and you had a slide going in home, which he really did.
He did slide.
He did slide.
He didn't slide from 10.
I find out the umpire of that game had been a former player.
I have never seen, you were always a fairly mild-mannered guy when it came to coaching, and but that day you were livid, and I'm sure and I don't blame you, and because once again it was our senior year's last game, as well as that we had lost the year before to Oak Park in the regional, so there was a nice heated rivalry between St. Pat's and Oak Park for a couple of years.
I had exchanged after that call. I had exchanged some. The Oak Park coach made a comment which I did not find appropriate, and then I made a comment which I'm sure he did not find appropriate, and that's how that went.
Yeah.
But no, we actually had won that game.
Yeah. But anyway, like I said, you got those uniforms. So it's interesting to know that even the other coaches used to give you a hard time about those. Yeah, I mean, it may have been a character builder, but the one thing that made me so personally upset is, now I played baseball from when I was 7 years old. I probably played for 15 or 16 years between high school and other kind of leagues, traveling teams and things like that. And all through my entire career, whether it was in Little League, and then, you know, the Babe Ruth Pony League, and then in high school, and then in these other traveling teams, I never got to wear a pinstriped baseball uniform.
A regular uniform.
And I always loved, because if you remember in the 70s, they went for those kind of, those what they thought were cool, where they had the waistbands,
mm-hmm,
and the different, and just the white pants. There wasn't, you know, they were trying to get away from the traditional look, which was always in my mind, I mean, the Yankees, were the that's a baseball uniform. The Yankee
pinstripes. Think of it this way: did Trout or Pujols or Mantle or Maris ever get to wear those uniforms that you wore?
No, very few people did. No, no. Richie Zisk.
Well, I'll tell you who did wear them. Who and says they were the most comfortable uniforms he wore? Steve Stone.
Oh, they were. As I said, that's why Chris Sale missed the boat on this. He should have said they were ugly, but he should have said.
He was obviously wrong in what he did. He lost his temper.
Yeah,
and he'll admit that. However, I don't. What I'd like to know, which I don't, had he let the team know before that day about those uniforms?
Right.
Did he let them know before the day, I don't want to wear those? Because if that were the case, and being a promotion, I can see where they had to stick to it, they didn't have to pitch him then.
Yeah, he could have pitched the next day then.
They could have pushed him back.
Yeah. So
the White Sox could have avoided.
Yeah, there's blame on both sides, but at the same time, I don't know if Sale should, regardless of whether he knew or not, or they knew or not.
He lost his temper. Yeah. He obviously came in a bad mood. And,
yeah, you
and
don't.
That just happened.
You don't.
Unless
do that.
He had put it on and legitimately it affected his pitching.
I mean, because believe me, there were several times in 3 years at St. Pat's that I had the same feeling that I wanted to cut up that uniform.
Really?
Without wearing it, but I didn't.
Well, there you go. You defended Chris Sale, and you're a Cubs fan.
But I was all, and then the zinger. I always felt it was a personal zinger from you to me. Was that the year after I left? As you said, you got new uniforms for the team, and what did they look like? They had pinstripes.
Did they have pinstripes?
Yes, the pants had pinstripes.
Okay, all right. Pants had pinstripes.
Yeah, the year I leave, you get these beautiful pinstripe uniforms. And meanwhile, for 3 years, I'm playing in some puke green pajamas.
I can see if you have to play in the uniform, and it's a bit baggy, which I guess it was. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, it's very baggy. It was very comfortable.
But it being baggy, it was comfortable. But was it comfortable to play ball in?
Well, yeah.
Did
I mean,
it inhibit you in any way?
No, not at all. In fact, from being a catcher, it was great because, once again, I mean, the squatting, going up and down, it was, I mean, to be honest with you, it was almost like, I mean, you know, it was like not wearing anything.
Now I can see Sale. He doesn't have what you'd call a real controlled delivery. There's a ton of movement.
Yeah, so maybe the way it hangs.
Flapping all over. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? Maybe he's got a legitimate. All I know is.
Well, he's not one of the bad guys in baseball.
No.
For Sale.
But he should have picked.
They looked at him as the team leader. When Frazier came over here, Frazier is known as a leader. He said to Chris Sale, and that's unusual for a pitcher to be the team leader.
Right.
But he said Chris Sale is the team leader.
Yeah.
So, obviously, he's respected there. I was surprised about the comment that Robin Ventura didn't back them.
Yeah.
Didn't back them because Ventura is, you know, as mild-mannered guy as you get. So.
Well, if you go to my Facebook page, folks, you will see a picture of me wearing said uniforms from St. Patrick. And to accompany this podcast, when we post it, you will also see some photos of me wearing it. So to prove that I did in fact wear the throwback uniform, although it was a throw up uniform when we wore it, not a throwback. But I wanted to just say that as much as it was interesting to always wear those uniforms because it did make us stand out, they were chosen by a diehard Sox fan, my former coach, and I'm happy to say more than 30 years later, someone who I still consider a friend. And so it's great to talk to Paul Demos, who had a very successful career at St. Pat's coaching. And in fact, not only did we bond because of our love of baseball, but as I do with so many of my friends, Paul, or coach, whatever you want to call him, is a huge Elton John fan. And so we bonded on Elton John. And in fact, if you remember, in 1980, you drove me and my then girlfriend and now wife to the concert at the Rosemont Horizon.
Okay.
You don't even remember that.
No.
No.
So many. I mean, in Milwaukee, we went to.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, there was
you had big connections. You knew members of the band.
Yeah, in fact, I brought you backstage that one time at the one in Tinley Park.
In Milwaukee, after the concert, we went to the bar of the hotel they were staying in, I believe.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Talking with some of the
band members. Yeah, that's right.
You knew so intimately.
Yeah.
You've done very well in meeting all these people, and there's a reason. Your personality, you're a sharp guy, Jim. You always were back then.
Well, I appreciate it. And so, like I said, it's great to have not only somebody that that you cross paths with, but as many people that I did go to high school with, including not only friends, but also, you know, teachers and, in this case, coaches. And you also were my freshman year English teacher.
That's right, and that's where we made the Elton John connection, I recall.
Yeah, because I found out that you were going to the solo show at the auditorium in 1979.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
right. So anyway, well, I want to thank Paul Demos for giving a little insight as to how the 1980, 81, and 82 St. Patrick's teams wore the same type of uniforms that Chris Sale hated so much, he tore them up. At least we never tore them up.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Well, thanks a lot, Paul. Yeah. It's great
to talk to you. I'll give you a ring, and I'll buy you lunch.
Okay, great. Take care. Thanks a lot. All right. We'll be right back right after this. And welcome back to Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. And as we do most shows here, I think we will take a little trip downstairs and go into the Pop Culture Club. And lo and behold, look who's down there. It's charter member Mick Kaler.
Hey, just so you know, they just finished dusting, and please use your drink coasters, okay?
There you go. So, welcome to another version, episode, encounter of the Pop Culture Club with, as I said, charter member Mick Kaler. And there's a few things going on in the pop culture world this week that I would like to talk about.
All right.
The first one is, have you been watching this summer, the last, I think, 3 or 4 weeks, have you been watching the ABC Game Night?
I never watched that show because.
their whole schedule.
Well,
they've got three.
In particular, I just want to address for a second. Okay, I have more of a life than needing to watch celebrities play charades. Okay, that's number one.
No, but ABC has three shows in a row. They've got Celebrity Family Feud. They've got Celebrity $10,000 or $100,000 Pyramid, and then they have Match Game with not just some schlub, but like one of the best actors of all time, Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, to think that he went from Glengarry, Glenn Ross with, excuse me, do I got your attention now?
Yeah.
Always be closing. Now, ABC.
Yeah.
Do I have your attention, please?
Well, now he's saying always be matching.
Yeah, exactly.
It's ABM. It's ABM.
1975 call. They want their game shows back.
Always be matching.
I'm serious. I'm watching the way. Wait a minute. This is the guy that held up the brass.
I know.
The brass stones and said you got to have a pair of these to sell. You know, you're wanting. These are the Glengarry leads. You don't get these, okay?
Glengarry is so fat. How fat is she? That when she walks down the street, she needs a blank.
Oh, I just watch as I go. Oh my! And he was the cool casino boss in
the cooler. Oh, I mean he's been everything. I mean
he acted with Meryl Streep. He was in bed with Meryl Streep.
He was married to Kim Basinger.
Yeah, and it's like like you said, it's like they did this when they said blank, and I'm just like, what?
Dumb Dora is so dumb.
Oh.
But anyway, so, I mean, the reason I brought this up is because it is ironic, and I think those shows are doing very well in that, you know, it's summer,
So it is summer. It's replacement time.
You know, yeah, it's light entertainment. Now, I have to say, I know that that Steve Harvey, who has a million jobs.
Right, doesn't have enough time in the day for all of them.
Yeah. I know that he has been hosting Family Feud for a while.
Yeah.
So I've never watched it, though.
No,
I was never a big fan of Family Feud. There's two things I didn't like about it. First of all, since I am a curmudgeon, I don't like when somebody gives a bad answer and they still go, good answer.
Oh, yeah, the clapping. And
yeah,
all
they
that,
all
yeah.
clap for everybody, good answer. And then they, of course, it's a horrible answer. And he goes, show me, you know, bathtub. It's like, well, wait a minute. You were just clapping,
yeah.
and you all said it, what a good answer it was, and then it gets the eh. So it
yeah.
wasn't a good answer. Why can't you just say, you know, I've heard a lot of, you know, if I was the host, I'd probably last like two episodes, because I would say, wow, you know what? I know there's no such thing as a bad answer, but that was a bad answer.
I'd be going, all right, one, two, three, eh.
Yes. Even before you do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, come on, crowd. Are we ready?
You know, I take a magic marker, just write an X on their head, say sorry.
Exactly.
Not going to happen.
So, and the one thing though that I think, as much as Richard Dawson became kind of a parody of himself when
right.
he first hosted it in the late 70s and early 80s, and he looked like he was inebriated.
Yeah.
And of course, his trademark then was to not just like kiss every female. But, like, really kiss.
Yeah.
I mean, it was actually, you know, it was puckered up. And I don't know if he ever slipped in the tongue, but, boy, he sure came close.
Yeah.
And it was. I mean, you could never get away with that today because it looked very sexist.
Exactly.
But the other side of the coin was, what I liked about the way Richard did it was he did it, you know, he kind of did it with a tongue-in-cheek kind of wink, wink, like, okay, you know, I know this show is stupid.
But people are watching, so here I am.
Yeah, so let's just have fun with it. But I know it's dumb. And, hey, look, I'm getting to kiss all these chicks.
Yeah.
So look at me.
Yeah,
whereas
I used to watch it sometimes when he was doing it. I miss the Gong Show. If they can't bring back the Gong Show, then what's the point?
We'll be back with more stuff right after the... Da, 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 da. Remember Gene, the dancing machine?
Yep. Chuck Barris was a genius, I swear. He really was.
We'll be back with more stuff. Remember toward the end he would wear a hat? You couldn't even see his eyes?
Yeah.
I mean, that show toward the end got really crazy. But when I watched Steve Harvey do it, because I tried to give these new shows a chance, it's just that Steve Harvey is trying to kind of mug.
Right.
And sort of, you know, act like every answer has a double meaning. What's so funny is that even though Richard Dawson was kissing these women, and it looked a little skeevy, you never felt like it was going to go any farther, you know. Whereas when Steve Harvey does it, every answer he gives that kind of mug look, like, ooh,
yeah.
did you hear that? And
yeah,
then it's like this double
entendre. Yeah.
Well, this double entendre, like everything is a sexual, you know, meaning. And it's just like, okay, slow down with that. It's funny one time. You know, you could do the "that's what she said" joke. And, hey, I'm a huge fan of the "that's what she said" joke.
Yeah.
I may have even invented it. But, you know, so I'm not crazy about the Steve Harvey thing. And then I always thought that $10,000 and then later $100,000 pyramid, initially hosted by Dick Clark, who also had 75 jobs, if you remember. I always liked that one. I always thought that was a pretty good game show.
Especially when you got to the round where you had to go in the circle to try to win the big money, because there was a lot of tension. I mean, you'd see the clock ticking down, and it's like, they got two more to go. Can they get the right things? And that was actually very fun. I wasn't such a big fan of the individual play, you know, between the two tables. But once a winner got to, you know, going for the big money, it was always very enjoyable.
Now, that's very astute of you, because you are exactly correct in that. What I didn't like was that the rules were different.
Yeah.
If you remember, and it's still the same way they play it now, when they play the initial part when they're trying to get to the winner's circle.
You can use all sorts of descriptive words.
Yeah, you could use your hands. Because, in fact, to your point, when you're in that circle, they put the clue giver in like hand restraints.
Yeah.
So you can't use your hands.
Yeah, and then when you get to the circle, it's things like French fries, oil, butter.
Things that are fried.
or things that are slippery, whatever.
Was that what it was? Things that are slippery? Why are French fries slippery? What are you talking about?
They're greasy.
Oh, geez. Thank God you and I are not in the winner's circle. Things that are slippery.
We'd be arguing back and forth.
Like, what are you talking about? French fries? No, things that are slippery are a shampooed rug, a wet tile floor.
Ice.
Slime. Not French fries. Why are French fries slippery? That's why I said things that are fried. Oh,
man. I have slipped on French fries more times than I care to admit. When I worked at White Castle, and I had suffered many an injury.
So here's the thing, too. So now I'm watching the new version, and I don't know if you have you watched that at all?
No.
Okay. I'm sorry, once again, I'm not on the Mike Strahan bandwagon.
No.
You know, he lisps.
He sounds like Sylvester the Cat.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't watch him with Kelly.
I left Kelly Ripa for these other shows on ABC.
Yeah. Suffering succotash.
Seriously. And the thing is, like you just said, though, like about Steve Harvey, they keep piling all these shows on.
I know.
Like,
this guy.
Good Morning America.
Yeah.
And you're going to do this show, and we're going to have you do some special correspondence. So we're going to send you everywhere.
Yeah. So he's another one that I remember I watched one episode, and I like the game itself. I think it's a very pure, very well-constructed game. So it's fun to watch it. But once again, like, there was an answer and somebody gave some crazy clue that, once again, was a little double entendre, sexual in nature, and he fell on the floor, you know, laughing. So now what gets me is, while the other two are, you know, they had, the cool thing about that show, too, is remember the little screen?
Yeah.
I love the screen. When they move the screen, it must be on some kind of like a Lazy Susan.
Yeah, or a little track, right?
Yeah, so I'd love to see. I would love one time, they should show what the screen looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's coming up? Is it just a word? Or is it a picture? I'd love to see. I want to see the screen. They never show you the screen. But anyway, so I like the way that it would always move. That was kind of cool. But so, meanwhile, while the game was being played, and now, of course, Rosie O'Donnell, for some reason, is on every game show. I don't know why, but she's
That's
on every game
job.
Show. Yeah, she's now the celebrity contestant on every show. But anyway, so while they were playing the game, they're showing Michael Strahan laying on the floor laughing.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, okay, guys. You know, just don't worry about Michael Strahan laughing so hard at something that wasn't that funny.
Well,
so I'm not crazy about that.
Well, we're getting back to Strahan, and like I said, Steve Harvey and, of course, Ryan Seacrest. That's one of the great showbiz problems. If one glass of something is good, then 10 must be great.
Exactly.
Okay? And that's what they do. And it's like, well, we'll give Ryan Seacrest 10,000 jobs and Steve Harvey 10,000 jobs and Michael Strahan. Pretty soon, Michael Strahan's going to be doing the ABC World News filling in for the guys that they have on now. That's what'll happen.
Bum, 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 bum.
Yeah, exactly.
Today, there was an earthquake.
It was very scary.
It was very scary. So anyway, but so now the one that intrigued me the most, I have to say, I loved Match Game. I mean, in its heyday.
Brett Summers.
With Gene Rayburn as the host. You had Brett.
Nelson Riley.
Now, of course, I have over the last several years, in a very subtle way, whenever you hear me go, I mean, that is my tribute to Charles Nelson Riley, because that was Charles.
Rip Taylor.
Yeah, he was kind of always going to go.
Yeah.
And so there was Charles, and then there was people, and then Richard, the three mainstays on the original. And what's so cool about it, if you remember about it, when Match Game first appeared, it started in 1973. It was called Match Game 73.
And then they keep adding it. At New Year's Eve, they say, we got a new sign to bring down. Here comes Match Game 74.
Exactly. You read my mind. The greatest thing, you always had to watch the Christmas Eve or the New Year's Eve episode.
Oh, yeah. They bring down the lights. Say, hey, it's Match Game 75.
Yeah.
Go.
And then all of a sudden, the new sign, the old sign would go up, and the new sign would come down, and they would have, like, noisemakers and hats and confetti. It was just like it was New Year's Eve. That was the coolest thing. And I think they did that until 78 or 79. I'm not sure how long the actual show ran with, because then it went into syndication and became a late night thing. But when it was on, it used to be on, I believe, here in Chicago, every day at like 2:30.
Mm-hmm.
So we could, I remember coming home, oh, maybe was it 3:30, maybe 3. But I know I watched it when I came home from school.
Right.
And, you know, once again, it was Brett and Charles and Richard Dawson. Now, later on, we have learned that apparently they used to film 3 or 4, if not 5 shows a day.
That's what most game shows do, yeah.
Yeah, now, back then, we didn't really know that.
No, of course not.
And so, you know, they would change clothes, obviously. But now more stories, now that, you know, it's been 40 years since these shows have been on, and, you know, books have been written and interviews have been done. Apparently, you know, you could tell that by some of those shows during the week that they filmed in one day, by the end of the day, the guest stars were pretty much completely drunk.
Right, just drinking all day.
I mean, you could see that Brett was drunk, and you could see that, you know, what was funny was Richard was always was a great player on that game, Richard Dawson. But you could see that at the beginning of the show, he was kind of quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you would watch later shows, you would always see him, and he would start to talk a little more.
Right, get a little slurry.
He would get a little slurry, and Brett was screaming, and you could just see that they were all a little drunk, and Betty White was always a regular. And then there were some of these C-list people who you didn't even know who they were, but they made a career on game shows, like Dick Gaudier.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Dick Gaudier, who's also done some Love American Style.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Dick Gaudier or Patty Deutsch.
Patty Deutsch is the one that, the other day when you brought up that name to me, I was like, oh, my God.
Patty Deutsch, I don't know. She looked like Creepella from the Flintstones.
Yeah, exactly.
She had this long red hair with these bangs, and she sort of had this nasal voice.
Yeah, she was kind of like the voice like Julie Kavner, only more obnoxious.
Yeah, exactly. But then Elaine Joyce was on. There were some people that were always, you know, they became professional. You know, Bill Cullen.
Yeah, professional panelists.
Yeah, they were professional panelists. And so, I mean, Match Game was funny because there was this little edge to the show because you could see that these guys were drunk.
Yeah.
We didn't know it back then, but they were acting a little goofy. Gene Rayburn was always flirting with the pretty contestants, and he was a little creepy.
Yeah, a little creepy looking.
Yeah, and so there was always that little weird tension going on. And then they used to have, you know, the actual game is a fun game with the, you know, Dumb Dora is so dumb when she stepped out of the, you know, she stepped over the cliff and she fell into a blank.
Yeah.
You know, so that was fun. But what was always kind of a weird thing about it was when you would see how the contestants completely didn't even understand the questions half the time.
Right, like they look like a dog staring into a fan. Just
yeah, and you could see that the stars, after a while, they didn't even care.
No,
you know, and so there was a rag. What I liked about it was the show was kind of it was almost like a subversive game show. It was like ragged.
Yeah,
you know, if you think about the game shows of the 70s, you know the. You know, the hosts always had, you know, the perfect smiles and, you know, they were perfectly dressed and Wink Martindale and Jim.
Fancy suits.
Yeah, Jim Peck. And there was, you know, what was the other guy? Kennedy. There was a Kennedy.
Bob Kennedy?
Bob Kennedy. They were always the same, you know, the same hosts would just be continually, you know, recycled on a new game show.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, you know, Alan Ludden was great on Password, who was Betty White's husband. But you know this. But Match Game just had that. It was a little subversive. It was
a little schlocky.
Yeah,
in a fun way when they do that.
And so what's funny about this new version is I think they've given Alec Baldwin a little leeway to take that road because he has made some comments that are not even double entendres.
They're just blatant.
Yeah, they're just blatant, like like offensive things, and they're talking about anatomy. I mean, they're using the words. I mean, it's like, wow, he's getting away with a lot.
It's nighttime TV now.
Now, I had to laugh because I've been watching him on and off. And now it looks like that, once again, Rosie O'Donnell is sitting in the Brett chair.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And there's this other guy from that, what's that new show with Ellie Kemper? The, you know, it's on Netflix. Oh, Kimmy Schmidt.
Oh, yeah. Unmistakable, unbelievable, Kimmy Schmidt,
yeah.
Whatever.
So there's the black guy, Titus.
Okay.
And so Titus now, it seems to be the Charles Nelson Reilly of that show. He sits next to Rosie in that seat. And then the other ones do seem to go away. Now, Jason Alexander was on the other day, which was kind of sad to see George Costanza.
Down to that level, right?
Yeah, because, you know, in the 70s, too, what happened was, to your point, not only were these recycled panelists, but then game shows sort of became kind of where, if your career, if you were an actor or an actress, if your career was kind of on the downslide, you took anything you could get.
Well, to give you an example of that movie Autofocus about Bob Crane.
Right.
The actor from Hogan's Heroes, at one point he's desperate for work and he's talking to his agent. He says, hey, get me on Hollywood Square. I don't have to be the center square, but get me on there.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
And so it actually...
You're exactly right about that. That it's like, well, I keep saying about the show that's on Channel 9, Celebrity Name Game. As soon as you're on that show, you're no longer a celebrity.
Now, what is Craig Ferguson doing? The guy had a great talk show.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure he's getting paid a nice buck. It keeps him out there.
And that's why he's doing it. And I think, to be honest, I think Craig Ferguson treats that show in kind of the same way.
Yeah, he does. You can see, yeah.
It's just like, hey, it's a paying gig. I got bills. I got a wife. I got a kid. I got to stay sober, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, you can see. Yeah, he's definitely has his tongue in his cheek, and he's kind of winking. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. But here was the shocker, though. Okay, I'll give you Rosie O'Donnell because, okay, everybody loves Rosie. She's had 17 different shows. They've all failed, but she continues to go on television. So
yeah.
I guess we all love Rosie. But here's the one. As I said, you know, it kind of varies between either a star that's trying to get some exposure, so they go on there so they're seen, or once again, it's somebody who may have been on hard times and they just want to be seen so they remind people of who they were. But here's one that shocked me last Sunday.
Okay.
I turn the show on. I look in the lower right corner where Betty White and Patty Deutsch used to sit. And there I see the name Cheryl.
Oh, yeah. I saw
and
that,
And so
too.
I'm looking at Cheryl, and I'm trying to figure out who's Cheryl. And it's this attractive woman, but I really can't make her out. And then I realize, sadly, she's had a lot of plastic surgery of late. It's Sheryl Crow!
Right. Tuesday Night Music Club, you know, All I Want to Do, and Steve McQueen, all those songs.
Well, talk about a brilliant mistake.
Yeah.
Why are you on, I mean, Cheryl, is Sheryl Crow? Now, you know, once again, she's like our age. So we've got this kind of misty memory of Match Game. So I'm looking at this in two ways from Cheryl's point of view. Cheryl either, I know she hasn't had a hit song in a while, but I can't believe she's reached the depths that she would go on a Match Game so that people would remember her.
Yeah.
Could that be the case? Or, I mean, put yourself in her shoes. Okay, so let's say that you were a star, you're your age, and someone says, hey, there's a new Match Game. Would you want to be on just because you watched it and it was kind of cool in the day?
It's possible, but again, I felt the same way you did. I did watch that when she was on, and I'm like, who is that? And then I heard her voice, and I recognized her voice. And you're right about the plastic surgery. I mean, her face has been redone more times than the Dan Ryan Expressway, so it's pretty serious.
Yeah, I did not know that was Cheryl, and I love Sheryl Crow.
Sure.
So I was surprised when I didn't even recognize her to say, wow, but I could not believe that she was on Match Game. And I've got to tell you, there's something going on with do you watch the way Alec Baldwin walks? Watch, you know, he's wearing, you know, he's kind of a bulky guy, and he's trying to get away with those skinny suits.
Yeah.
It doesn't look good on Alec Baldwin, and he's...
Yeah, he looks kind of stuffed.
Yeah, he's kind of, he looks like he's trying to stuff 3 pounds of bologna into a 1 pound bag, you know? But I, of all three, that's the one I do watch Match Game, just because I think Alec is at least trying to bring some of the original kind of, you know, raggedy, kind of risque, you know, element to that show. Because at the end of the day, it is just a silly show. You're just filling in blanks.
Right.
You know. So I didn't know if you've watched those, but at the end of the day, I still have to think, you know, there's some ideas just like Ghostbusters, as we've learned. Sometimes it's best to leave well enough alone.
Yeah, throw them on those rerun channels where you can watch the game shows from the old days and just leave it at that.
So real quick here, Mick, we are in Chicago. We are in the midst of Lollapalooza.
Didn't you play the hacky sack game with me yesterday?
Yeah, of course. Well, I'm just outside on Michigan Avenue playing hacky sack.
I was.
Although, inspired. No, now I'm playing Pokemon Go. I mean, heck with hacky sack. Now everybody's playing Pokemon Go at Lollapalooza. Yeah. I guarantee you, nobody's even watching the bands. They're all seeing if there's a Pokemon behind all the lead singers.
Yeah, they're checking like the amplifiers. They're checking the toilets.
Yeah, like what's the big name? Who's the big name at Lolla this year?
Red Hot Chili Peppers are coming back again.
Yeah, so like all of a sudden people are like, hey, wait a minute. There's Pikachu behind Flea.
Right.
You know, go collect him. They're not even going to be paying attention.
The thing, you know, and again, I went to, I think, one all-day music festival in 83 when the Police opened up their tour at Comiskey Park.
Sox Park, right, definitely. Yeah, that was
the
was that the Synchronicity? Was that the Synchronicity tour?
Yeah, Synchronicity tour.
Yeah.
And we were in the grandstand, so we weren't in the sun, and we were pretty close to the stage, but in the grandstand. It was the only time I would ever do that. And the fact that these – and I admire some of these kids that will do this. They go all – now it's 4 days. It used to be 3 days of Lollapalooza.
I know.
4 days. But here's the best part. And here's the part, Jim, where – and I know we're going to sound old. I don't care.
In my day.
The music is inconsequential.
Oh, without a doubt.
Because the shows sold out before one act was ever mentioned that they were playing.
Is that true?
That is a true story.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Dean Richards was talking about that on Channel 9, and he didn't mention the part about the music being inconsequential because Dean's too nice.
Right.
I'm going to tell it like it is. This is a happening.
Right.
This is an event. You rent your hotel room with 10 of your smelly friends, and you're all out there in the mud and the dirt and the, you know, the bad food and the tofu and all that stuff for 4 days. Everybody wants to do it. They want to be part of the scene. That is all that is about.
Well, and I think, once again, we've talked about the differences in terms of the ability to attract.
Right.
You know, and the loss of the communal musical experience, whereas, you know, 30, 40 years ago when there was only radio to and maybe a little television, obviously in the 80s with MTV, to bond over certain bands. But at that time, since there was kind of one source, everybody's favorite band were basically within the four or five bands. Everybody had the same favorite band.
Yeah, it was Springsteen or it was a Huey Lewis, yeah, but Madonna, I mean, whatever it was.
Yeah, so you could go and so that's why even today, as those baby boomer bands now are still playing, they can fill an 80,000 seat stadium with one act, whereas a place like Lollapalooza, it takes 100 to gain any because everything is so fragmented. If you took, you know, 15 millennials and asked them who's your favorite band, there's a good chance that nobody would even have the same one as out of 10.
Yeah.
Whereas 40 years ago, you would say, you know, Led Zeppelin, you know, Boston, the Police. I mean, everybody would say the same three or four bands.
Well, and to bring your point a little further, and again, you're right about all these bands that they need to attract all these crowds and sell out the Lollapalooza. That's why, as much as I'm not the biggest fan of, say, a Taylor Swift or a Coldplay, I admire the fact that, I mean, I think Coldplay played two shows last week.
At Soldier Field, correct.
And Taylor Swift, I think, did three, you know, last year. And again, I like some of their music, but not a lot of it. But the fact that one act can just say, hey, guess what? 240,000 people are going to come out in 3 days and see my show. That's pretty incredible.
Well, think about in October, in the same site by the same promoters who put on Coachella every year, just outside of Los Angeles. Once again, that's a 2 day or 3 day festival for two weekends, and there's every band in the world, and it becomes, like you said, this event. Whereas, meanwhile, they are now getting one with just the classic rock bands. There's two bands a night.
Yeah, the Who with the Stones, yeah. And McCartney and Dylan.
And they sold the entire thing out. The other ones don't even sell out.
Yeah, well, and this goes back to this thing again. And again, we're going to sound old. Okay, I'll give you a band that's playing.
I always like to have fun. Yeah, I like to have fun with this, Mick. So let's give some of the names of the bands.
Okay, there's a band called Lettuce. I know it's normally something you get at the grocery store.
Now, would you like some protein with that?
Yeah, you want some beans in
there? Would you like to add a protein? A chicken?
Okay, so you got lettuce, all right? Now, Jim, please tell me, when will the Lettuce Greatest Hits album be out?
Well, I think after their next album, because then they'll have 10 songs.
Okay, yeah, right, there you go. But again, this going back to this longevity issue, and I joke about this, and I know I sound like a jerk, but I really don't care. Lollapalooza, most of those bands, as soon as the festival's over, they're going to go back to Starbucks and work as baristas, okay? That's the deal.
So what are some of the names? Because, you know, it's funny, before the show started, Mike Heidemann, who's the producer of this show every week and came on with us a couple of weeks ago to talk about, what were we talking about with him?
Oh, the Pokemon stuff.
Oh, the Pokemon thing, because I wanted to get his view. Yeah, and so we were just talking, Mike's really into music, and so I was just trying to pick in his brain. And he was even saying that, you know, here's a guy, you know, Lollapalooza is right in his wheelhouse.
Right.
And even, you know, he didn't know half of the bands.
Here's a band called City in Color.
All right.
Danny Brown.
Oh, Danny Brown.
Played yesterday, as a matter of fact.
Oh.
Okay, there's one today, Friday the 29th, when we're taping this. Mike Snow.
The Snowman.
Duke Dumont.
Okay.
MG. The aforementioned Lettuce.
Lettuce, of gas. That's going to be
the... Here's what I like this one. Frightened Rabbit.
Now, that one you're making up.
I think I had that at a restaurant. No, I'm not making that up. I had that at a restaurant. I said, I'd like the Frightened Rabbit, please.
You know, I'm sorry. You know, once again, I'm not trying to... It's so hard not to sound like you're 100.
No, you know what it is, Jim?
But, think about it. The Who is probably one of the best band names in history. Because it cuts across, it's working on so many layers.
Yep.
You know, it's just, in like the Rolling Stones, there's a history in that they were a blues-based band, and there's a blues-based history in, you know, that name and things like that. And then you hear... You know, some of these bands, like you said, that not only is their music disposable, but they try to come up with these ridiculous names just to be ridiculous.
Here's one called Years and Years.
Years and Years.
Local Natives. Block Party. Seven Lions. Here's one. This one I did order this at a restaurant. Snails.
Just Snails.
Yeah, not the Snails. Just Snails.
Is it with an S? It's not Snail.
It's Snails with an S.
It's plural.
Yeah, it's plural. Snails.
Yeah, they sit around for like 3 hours going, do we go plural or singular? Are we snail or are we snails?
But I admire the kids who are dedicated that jam the trains all weekend. The metro station is like a zoo to go down.
And it smells like a zoo too. It smells like the Gorilla House.
Yeah, I mean it's just ridiculous. And I admire the fact that they want to be part of this. And we talked about this before with the Pokemon stuff and other things, that they want to be part of this happening. But it's like, well, can't you be like part of a happening of something that's at least halfway worthwhile?
Well, and the thing is, too, I would be tempted maybe to go one time. But you know what? I would feel like I'm crashing somebody else's party.
No, that too.
Well, they don't want me. This is a fest for really 18 to 25-year-olds. They don't want me there. And to be honest with you, I don't really want to be there.
Well, I'll give you a quick example of that. Back in 91 when the Bulls won their first championship.
Yeah.
Okay. I took a friend. She and I went down to the celebration at Grant Park, okay? We were one of like a zillion people, right?
Right.
Super hot. They were selling bottles of water for like $5 a piece. We were dying. We were sucking down water like crazy. So I went the first year, saw all the speeches, the whole thing. The next year, I was at work, and they had the celebration on television. And they show from the helicopter those crowds.
Right.
And I looked at it on TV, and I said, I can't believe I was one of those people last year. I can't believe I actually did that.
You know, I mean, there's something about that. It's never appealed to me. I've never been one to, as I said, when something gets that popular, I walk away from it.
Yeah, and again, like I said, I mean, you know, and in the past, I mean, McCartney's played Lollapalooza, which is a big deal, and that's a great thing. I mean, especially for young kids to see Paul McCartney, but you've got to sit there all day through all these bloody bands.
And then there's got to be crossover of bands. You can hear other bands when you Grant Park's not that big.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so anyway. Well, I want to once again thank Mick Kaler for stopping by.
We just dumped on everything today, didn't we?
this was a nice get-off-my-lawn version of Pop Culture Club, but always fun. We're talking about game shows and, of course, a little Lollapalooza thrown in there. Thanks a lot, Mick.
You bet, pal.
All right. And I want to thank you for listening to this 11th episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. I hope you'll continue to click in every Monday for a new episode. It is Captain Podtastic from the end of the web to your screen.